Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, finding sanctuary in our frenetic lives. Find out why a Benedictine abbot is on the way to becoming a best-selling author. How a simple text message put a human face on the suffering of refugees in the Horn of Africa, and Catholics online. Is the Church really making the most of internet technology? Welcome to the programme. 5 steps for finding sanctuary. 5 phrases for easy meditation. And how to apply ancient monastic wisdom to our whirlwind modern lives. In a nutshell, that's what you'll get if you pick up a copy of Finding Sanctuary by Abbot Christopher Jamieson, head of the Benedictine community at Worth Abbey in the south of England. And if that name sounds familiar, well, so it should, because he's the man who featured in the TV show The Monastery, watched by over 3 million viewers when it was first broadcast on BBC Two in May 2005. The 3-part programme followed 5 ordinary men who spent 40 days inside the monastery, living alongside the monks and learning about the Benedictine spirituality which shapes their daily lives. It was so popular that a follow-up programme has since been produced, together with a similar show tracking 4 women's experiences in a Poor Clare's convent nearby. Father Christopher's book, meanwhile, has become something of a bestseller, snapped up by people with no apparent interest in religion and no contact with any Christian church. So what's the secret of his success? Or is he selling out the faith, as some fear, by simply cashing in on public interest in New Age spirituality?
Look, the basic expectation is that we now live in a society where most people say, I'm not religious. But the good news is that they usually preface it by saying, or they usually add to that, but I am spiritual. And we have to start to show how religion is at the service of spirituality, without an agenda, but rather we have a religious offering to feed the spiritual life of the spiritual people of this country.
With that key concept in mind, Father Christopher helped set up a website to cope with the huge interest sparked by the monastery TV programmes, and then set about writing a book to make the monastic tradition more accessible to non-religious readers.
The book was a result of an invitation from the excellent publisher, Weidenfeld & Nicholson. They began rather charmingly by saying, look, we don't normally publish religious books, although we did publish the works of the late Pope John Paul II, which was rather encouraging. But they said, we feel there is a space in the market here for a book coming through secular outlets, which is actually a religious book. And this was really very interesting and returns to the earlier theme. They felt that the market was saturated with the new spirituality movements, with New Age therapies, with all of that. We all know about that stuff, so to speak. But they felt the monastery showed that actually those same people who buy those books are now open to classic religious insights. They no longer have to be coming from a New Age source. And therefore they asked me to write a book from the classic Catholic monastic tradition, which might speak to the situation of people today. And they said, please begin with where people are today and then show how the monastic tradition can enrich their spiritual lives and guide them on a path through that, as you did the people in the monastery. So I was thrilled to do that, and I learned a great deal about how to conduct this dialogue by an excellent editorial team who helped me to realise when I was using language that would not be accessible and who helped me to understand what was going to be understood and what wasn't going to be understood. And that has been a great learning curve for me. When I'd finished the book, I was concerned by the question you asked earlier, have I actually dumbed down the tradition in some way? I was concerned about that. And so I sent it to a fellow abbot who is an incredibly able man who I've known for many, many years. In fact, knew him since I was, we were both lay students together. And said to him, have I been faithful to the tradition? And he said, oh yes, he said, I want to read this book out in my refectory for all the monks to hear. It would do them good. So I was really encouraged by that.
So who would you personally say the book is aimed at? I mean, is it more for the monks in their monasteries, or is it more for people, is it also for people who know nothing about religious life,
no,
or indeed the church?
It's specifically aimed for lay people, not for religious or priests, and it's specifically aimed for non-religious lay people. It is clearly directed towards the person who says, I'm not religious, but I am spiritual. That's the focus. Those are the people who've been buying it. I discovered that it's now being sold in W.H. Smith because people have been going into W.H. Smith, which is, people need to know, is our standard high street news agents here in Britain, and asking for the book. You know, that's the kind of popularity it's had.
With all this new media interest, where do you find time to keep up the running of the community at Worth as well, I wonder?
Well, one of the things I've discovered about the media is that, funnily enough, the media is not something that's deeply intrusive into the monastic life. Provided you treat the media with respect, they treat you with respect. And I say to them, well, I'll see you next week. It's not like a news agenda. If you had a big news agenda running, then it does become more complex and you're under pressure. But when you, in a sense, have a message to communicate, which they're interested in hearing, then I negotiate and say, well, I can do it next week, but not this week. And a small TV camera crew is not particularly intrusive. If we can reach 3 million people through the presence of a production team of two, then, you know, that's a pretty good ratio. It's a way of communicating the gospel through the monastic tradition in an unobtrusive way.
You mentioned this problem of language that is accessible to people who increasingly know nothing about the church. And it's a real problem, isn't it, within
Yes.
the Catholic Church today. What is your message, if you like, that you've learnt from these recent experiences to other church leaders who are wondering how to deal with this problem?
I think we have to start with the lived experience of people today. So in the beginning of the book, I speak in a chapter called How Come I'm So Busy? I speak about the pressures that people feel in their day-to-day lives in Western society. And that strikes an immediate chord, that this person knows my situation. So you first of all have to show that you understand their situation, that you're not scolding them, that you're not condemning them, that you know the difficulties that life presents them with today. Secondly, you then have to go through your own lived experience as a Christian, and you have to offer them elements of that which speak to the situation that you've just described. So for me, it's meant being able to take elements from my own lived experience of prayer and the contemplative setting of a monastery and to suggest to them how they might live that out in their own lives. Now, to bridge that gap requires, I think, a dialogue with ordinary people at a very personal level about how you might do this. And we've been very blessed in that, following the TV programme, hundreds of people have been on retreat at Worth, and they have helped us to understand how we can find the language which enables that communication between ordinary lived experience and the lived experience of the Christian life. We've found ways to enable that dialogue through a personal dialogue. We then take that experience onto a wider scale and can write about it.
I've seen your approach sometimes described as Benedict Light. I mean, have you had criticism, serious criticism, from people who think that perhaps you're taking a too modern, if we can call it, approach to the faith, that there is a risk inherent in this kind of dialogue with the modern world?
I think there's two responses to that. The first one is, I think it's only Benedict Light if it's read quickly. I think if the book is read slowly and at depth, then the whole of the tradition is implicitly present within it. And that's why I was encouraged by the response of other monks to the book. Secondly, the accusation of selling the tradition short is one that is usually made of those who succeed in engaging a new audience. I think the Bible is full of such examples, including our Lord himself, who got into great trouble with those who said he seemed to be selling the tradition short.
Future projects? Do you have anything in the offing after such a successful past year?
Well, the BBC are very engaged now in a whole new raft of religious broadcasting. They believe that the monastery represents a turning point in religious broadcasting in this country. Mark Thompson, the Director General, has told us that himself. The TV critics are now speaking in that way. Just last week, one TV critic, after the monastery revisited, was saying there is now a great deal more religious broadcasting, and what's more, here is what is coming up in the future. For example, the BBC has commissioned A New Life of Christ for 2008, which is a marvellous piece of news, and is specifically the part of the BBC that we deal with is interested in continuing to work with us on some new projects as well, which are fascinating because they're talking about taking the book, Finding Sanctuary, Monastic Steps for Everyday Life, and seeing what happens when they give that book to ordinary people out there and filming their attempt to live out those steps in their day-to-day life and making that into a new documentary. I think that could be a fascinating project.
Abbot Christopher, it's been lovely talking to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Philip.
Father Christopher Jamieson is abbot of the Benedictine community at Worth Abbey, where the monastery TV programmes were made, and author of Finding Sanctuary, Monastic Steps for Everyday Life. The everyday sound of a mobile phone alerting its owner to an incoming text message. In the London offices of the World Food Programme, where the message was received, it's a sound heard on and off all day long. Cancelled meetings, rescheduled appointments, plus a few messages from friends or families at home. But this one was different. It came from a remote refugee camp in northeastern Kenya, a drought-ridden corner of the world where over 200,000 Sudanese and Somali refugees survive in makeshift huts with handouts from UN food aid workers. Earlier this year, the WFP was forced to cut food rations to the refugees by 20% due to lack of funds. That was before heavy rains caused flooding and further devastation to this disaster-ridden Horn of Africa region. The sender of the message was an enterprising young Somali man who fled the fighting and famine in his home country as a young boy some 15 years ago. His name? Mohamed Sokor.
The situation is very desperate, very desperate. Large number of malnutritional children.
Speaking to us on a crackly phone line from that same refugee camp in Dadaab, northern Kenya, Mohammed explained why he'd sent an SMS to a World Food Programme official in London.
This is because I thought that they are not aware of the situation, or if it's so, then they can at least improve the situation here in the camp. That's why I was encouraged to contact them.
Dear sir, he wrote, there's an alarming issue here. People are given too few kilograms of food. You must help.
In some respects, this was a very direct appeal for help, the kind of appeal that you're not used to getting much of the time, particularly if you're sitting in an office in London.
The recipient of Mohammed's message was Greg Barrow, Senior Public Affairs Officer for the UN's World Food Programme in London. He told my colleague Paul Anthem he believes it's the first time a refugee has taken advantage of modern technology to launch a direct appeal on behalf of those in the camps who find it increasingly hard to survive.
And he was essentially saying to me that he and his fellow refugees in this camp, Dagahali camp, which is in a remote place called Dadaab, were short of food. And could I do something about it, as it was the responsibility of the World Food Programme to feed them? So I think everybody in developed industrialised nations like the United Kingdom, Italy, most of Europe, North America are used to receiving text messages from friends, colleagues, businesses, organisations, entities which are putting appeals out. But it's quite rare to get an individual appeal from a refugee who's living in a refugee camp in northern Kenya, an area which I should add, is not just harsh at the best of times, but is currently suffering from a very, very extensive drought that's affecting the local population. And I think this is a sign of how technology has moved forward, and that individuals in these areas are taking advantage of technology to perhaps exploit it to their advantage, and all strength to them.
Now, obviously, the problems that we've got in this area, Greg, we're looking at a lack of funding, and we're looking at the problems with the drought as well. The funding to start with, it seems there's been quite a cutback, and that's restricting the work that a lot of the aid agencies can carry out. Can you explain a bit, give us a bit of background to that?
Well, for the past 4 to 5 months, we have been highlighting a very extensive drought situation, not just in northern Kenya, but in the whole of the Horn of Africa region, that northeastern tip of the African continent, which has attracted a reasonable amount of funding, enough to make sure that we can just about work our way through feeding up to 10 million people in that area over the next few months as they struggle through towards the next harvest. But what you have to understand is that alongside this humanitarian crisis that's taking place in the region, there are, in a sense, micro crises, and these are crises that involve other issues, and this is perhaps where this refugee and his story comes into play. I mean, it's probably not particularly well known that in Kenya at the moment there are around 230,000 refugees, mainly from Somalia and Sudan, living in pretty abject conditions in refugee camps, and they've been living in those camps for sometimes up to 15 years. And their plight very rarely attracts much attention. And that was what was so poignant about this message from this individual, Mohamed Sokor. He, in a sense, put a name and a face to the plight of those refugees whose voices are so rarely heard, whose issues are lost in the wider scheme of things and very rarely make the news. And I think it helped to highlight this ongoing problem of refugees, not just in Kenya, but around the world. For example, this year, the World Food Programme is aiming to feed around 1.9 million refugees in various parts of the world. Their plight is very, very rarely heard. It's a sort of forgotten disaster, if you like.
And of course, the suffering of these refugees, Greg, totally compounded by the weather conditions and the heavy rain, the ongoing flooding. And this is really just another menace for the people, isn't it?
Yes, the conditions they live in are pretty awful at the best of times. I've travelled up to those camps in northern Kenya. I've visited the camps around Dadaab several times. This is a remote part of the world, a very dry, arid part of Kenya where there's very little vegetation. The climate there is pretty punishing, extremely hot during the day, and it can get quite cool at night. And people are living in difficult conditions. They're living in makeshift shelters that they've constructed, maybe out of pieces of branch and wood that they found in the surrounding area, covered with various bits of plastic sheeting and cloth, whatever they can find. And it's frankly a miserable life for those refugees up there. They have no prospect of returning to their home country in Somalia because of the security problems that prevail over there. And at the same time, they're stuck in these camps where they have very little to do, very little options in terms of employment. And it's just a waiting game for them. And all the time, their lives are just dribbling away.
Since the days of Christ himself, the church has always had a special concern for refugees and for all those forced to flee their countries seeking safety and decent living conditions. In many refugee camps, priests and religious are in the front lines, alongside other aid agencies supplying food, shelter and other forms of practical help to the most vulnerable and forgotten victims of conflicts. And more recently, the church has been stepping up its crucial advocacy role, calling on governments, the UN and other influential institutions to support the rights and needs of refugees. As head of the Vatican's Council for All Migrants and Itinerant Peoples, Cardinal Renato Raffaele Martino says this is an increasingly important part of the church's social ministry.
Because this is based on the gospel, and as you heard, I was 16 years a representative of the Holy See to United Nations, and in my 16 years are countless the interventions that I made in exactly in the name of, on behalf of the refugees, and I proposed the refugee, not a number, but a human face.
Putting a human face to the millions of refugees around the world is exactly what Mohamed Sokour did with his urgent text message to the World Food Programme office in London. Listening to his voice, it's hard to ignore his plea and just write him off as another anonymous victim of Africa's man-made and natural disasters. If, alongside its regular food rations, the WFP could hand out mobile phones with the numbers of presidents, prime ministers and other influential people, then maybe such personal appeals could reach the hearts and pockets of those in a position to help, including perhaps each one of us.
What you see here is technology being used to bridge what in many respects is a chasm in terms of the difference between the lives that we live in the industrialized world and the lives that those refugees live in those camps. Suddenly it throws a sort of line across that chasm and allows that individual who perhaps is normally cut out of our lives and not even considered, who is just some anonymous number in sub-Saharan Africa, to make his plight aware to the rest of the world, to give an identity to it, to put a story and a life behind it, and perhaps bring home the reality of the difficulties that he's challenged with on a day-to-day basis. And perhaps it makes it more persuasive for those of us who live in relative comfort to do a little bit more about it.
Greg Barrow there, Senior Public Affairs Officer for the World Food Programme in London, talking to my colleague Paul Anthem. And earlier you heard Cardinal Renato Raffaele Martino, head of the Vatican's Council for Migrants and Itinerant Peoples, and Mohamed Sokour, a Somali refugee living in the Dagahali camp in northern Kenya. And finally, how can the church make full use of the internet's potential, especially in areas of education and mission? That was the question being asked at the latest Christian Internet Conference that brought together church experts in the field of online communications from across the European continent. The Christian pioneers of the web were quick to see the internet as a new means of communication and evangelization for the church. But how can this technology be used more effectively in an age where the internet is embedded into the everyday life of society? Well, among those who participated in the European Christian Internet Conference was Barry Dowd, webmaster for the Catholic Diocese of Middlesbrough in England. He spoke to my colleague Susie Hodges about some of the challenges ahead.
Well, there's a need to meet particular groups within the wider world. For example, reaching young people through development of material that's appropriate for them in their learning about the Catholic Church and Christian belief. But there's also a recognition that the internet is still the domain of the educated and wealthy, and more must be done to use the potential of the internet to reach out to the poor and the vulnerable.
So do you think this digital divide is widening or narrowing?
I would suspect that it's narrowing, because there have been quite a number of initiatives to bring internet technologies into the third world, into poorer countries. We've got statistics showing, for example, what languages are being used or what countries are accessing websites, and from that we can make some guesses as to who it is.
Is it the case that now every Catholic parish and diocese does have its own website and that this is used fairly extensively?
I can only talk from my experience in England and Wales, where all of the dioceses, I think there are 22, have their own diocesan website. Within that, within the parishes, the situation is very different. There are quite a lot of parishes that do have websites, and there are quite a lot of communities which have websites. So there'd be organisations, local organisations, Catholic Women's League and so on, that have websites. But many parishes still do not.
Does it tend to depend on the individual?
Well, I think this is the heart of the debate at the conference about the realization of virtual Christian communities, because in many senses, individuals are running websites where we're trying to build a sense of community and a shared experience. That situation is obviously changing because we've got good practice to draw on. We've got ideas and imagination drawn in from elsewhere. So the sharing of ideas at this conference has been tremendous, and that will reflect, I'm sure, in the work of the people who attended.
And when it comes to the people that work for the church, not just the archbishops, bishops, the priests, but also the lay personnel, are they given adequate training on how to exploit the internet to its full potential?
I think this is something which is emerging from good practice that already goes on in dioceses and parishes and within organisations. It's something that is beginning to happen. And one of the real beauties of this conference has been the bringing together of people who have been, in some cases, working in isolation or as part of a small group into a wider group where there's much more potential for interchange of ideas.
Could there be more collaboration, in your view, between the various Christian denominations in online communications?
I think so. There are some excellent models out there. I would also extend that even further and to say that the inclusion of people of faith, bringing their own experiences to bear and to help each other, because the part of the brief of developing the idea of community means that we do share what we are doing.
These are the challenges, but there are also many dangers connected to the internet. What can the Catholic Church do in this field to warn the faithful?
There are quite a few things that can be done. I mean, obviously, with regard to security, there are different legal protections and different legal accountabilities into the different countries. But on top of that, there's quite a lot of sort of voluntary self-control within institutions. The church can also promote the need for media competence in how we go about communicating online. A key thing here, of course, is the issue of authenticity, because in the internet there is anonymity, which can in itself be very useful. But there's also the need that when we're looking for somebody who is speaking with authority on something, that we know where to find it. Not everything on the internet is of equal value.
Do you foresee new ways of using the internet that are going to be adopted by the Catholic Church in the years to come? Is it possible to see in what direction things are moving in this field?
It's quite difficult to see that with any precision, because the rate of change in the technological world, it seems to be ever accelerating. But they will arise, and provided we have the necessary skills and motivation to communicate what we have, which is the key thing. We have this fabulous message of good news that we need to use the technology to communicate it to the wider audience. We will use what arises.
Barry Dowd, webmaster for the Catholic Diocese of Middlesbrough in England, speaking to my colleague Susie Hodges. And that brings us to the end of today's programme, but we'll be back on the air at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. Don't forget you can always find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org and click on the English icon. I'm Philippa Hitchin. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.